Mother, man.
Spreading faster than a case of the clap in a trailer court. Able to shatter eardrums within a 666-mile radius. A podcast more brutal than all the rest. It's Murder Metal Mayhem! We have the pleasure of doing this interview with author Steve Stout, who wrote the book, The Starved Rock Murders. He's also a part-time writer for The Times in Ottawa, Illinois. We are also based very close and here in Central Illinois. Steve, thank you for taking the time to speak with us from the Murder Metal Mayhem podcast. I have my co-hosts, Chris Shawback and Joey Cashman, here with me. But how are things up there in Utica with you, Steve?
It's a beautiful afternoon here in Utica, Illinois. I live about a half mile from Starved Rock State Park, and great to be on the show with you guys today.
Awesome. Yeah, not being from here, you would think Utica is somewhere else, because it doesn't look like the rest of Illinois.
No,
it's very beautiful and mountainous, and it just doesn't look anything like where we are in the middle of corn and bean fields.
So. Yeah, how I describe the Starved Rock area is that it's the place in Illinois where canyons cut the prairie. And you're right.
Yeah, pretty much.
You're right. There are places in Starved Rock where you don't feel like you're in Illinois anymore. It's very dramatic hikes, very unbelievable, lovely waterfalls and canyons. And there's like 18 canyons in Starved Rock State Park, and with miles and miles of hiking. And I think, of course, I'm supposed to think, because I call it my park. My park is not only the finest park in the state park in the state of Illinois, it's one of the finest state parks in the nation, actually.
It's a beautiful place.
We still attract, over 2 million visitors a year.
Oh, wow.
Here to Starved Rock, and it's just really important to the recreational needs of the entire state, I think. I'm so happy that I live right outside the park.
Yeah,
yeah, I would be too.
Just a great spot for me to live, and a great for a photographer and a guy interested in Illinois history as I am. So
yeah,
it's a beautiful spot.
Now, what was it about the Starved Rock murders that inspired you to write a book in 1982?
Actually, it was kind of strange. I moved to LaSalle County in 1974 after graduating Illinois State University, and I didn't even I've heard of Starved Rock, but I had never been there. I didn't really know exactly where it was.
Oh, wow.
But when I first moved to town, I got interested in a story. I worked at the local LaSalle newspaper as a photographer. I got interested in a story about the 1909 Cherry mine disaster in Cherry, Illinois, where 259 men and boys were killed.
Oh, wow.
On November 13th, 1909, and it was such a dramatic and horrific story when you read about it, because it's a struggle of immigrants, struggle of poor people working in the mines. It's a struggle of child labor, how they put these 8, 9, 10-year-old boys down the mine to work. So there were dozens of those kids killed in this disaster. And I wrote a historical novel about it, because I really wanted to capture the emotional impact of such a tremendous disaster on a small little town in the middle of Illinois. People really don't think of mine disasters in Illinois.
There's definitely mines here.
So that book took me about 4 years to write, because I worked full time. And then about the last year, when I was struggling to get that book done, somebody at a news meeting we had in the newsroom, they were talking about a crime that happened in another part of the county, and somebody said, well, maybe Uyghur got loose, and the whole room laughed. I didn't laugh. I go, I don't get this joke.
Right.
Who's Uyghur? He was the Starved Rock killer. That's the first time I heard those words. Mm. He was the Starved Rock killer. And I go, I still don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
They said, look it up. And I found out every time somebody tells me to look up things, it takes years out of my life. So I looked up the newspaper accounts of the murders and what I could find, and I was stunned at the massive amount of publicity this crime generated in 1960. It was unbelievable. It was not a national story. It was an international story.
Right.
I mean, it was just, you know, the discovery of three bodies in a recreation area. It blew up into this great mystery. It lasted the entire summer of 1960. People were scared. The local authorities were beyond their capabilities, that's for sure. What happened to these three ladies? How could these three lovely women from Riverside, Illinois, just come to the park for a few days of rest relaxation and end up being murdered in one of the canyons? And as I got into it and talked to people about it, more and more people said, well, you know, Steve, the guy convicted didn't do it. Well, you know, Chester Wiggers in it, Steve. And I could hear this stuff over and over and over. And I go, well, geez, you know, I should just... Everybody just has their own personal, all the townies, as I call them. I have become one now. But all the townies, you know, just said, well, the wrong guy was convicted of the murders. So I said, well, you know, I don't know anything about it. So I can start fresh and let's find out for myself. I'll just go through everything myself and let's just write a book. Nobody, oddly enough, had ever put the entire story together in book form. And it just grew out of that hearing about the mystery of Starbrock. When really, after 40 some years of investigating this crime, there is no mystery to me.
Yeah,
it's not a mystery, and we'll probably get into this later after some of your questions. But the interesting thing to me is that in most murder cases, most serious crime cases, there are questions left unanswered. Okay?
How about that?
Are there questions from this crime that have no answers yet? But I also contend that the answers to these questions would not prove Chester Wiggers innocent. They're just questions that we don't have answers for. Doesn't mean it would change the case. Doesn't mean it would change the resolution of the case. And that's what the that's what I like to, you know, tell people nowadays.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a big contingency out there that think that Chester Wiggers is innocent of this crime and that he was railroaded. But usually, people who I call them the Free Chester Wiggers movement, usually these people present, you know, logical arguments to what limited facts they have, and not facts. Limited rumors that they address, but it's interesting to me is what they leave out,
right,
trying to prove this man innocent,
right?
And it all boils down to, and I don't know how much we're going to get in the case. It all boils down to: can one unarmed man attack, intimidate, and ultimately kill three women, each of whom were larger than he was, without any weapon? Well, people, when you think of that, say, well, no. Well, they put their sensibilities on this crime. You know, I tell my friends now, it was a different time. And when women ask me about this case, I always get a little, you know, aggressive and say, well, when's the last time you took a hike in a skirt? When's the last time took a hike in a dress?
Right.
That's how these women were going on a hike in March. In the snow.
Right.
Skirts and dresses.
Yeah, not the best.
Women don't do that now. I maintain if you're alone and you stop my wife and two of her friends on the pass without a weapon and you cause them trouble, you attack them, you intend to rob them, they'll beat the crap out of you.
Right.
Yep.
But this was a different time.
Right.
And they always say, Steve, go ahead and explain to me how he did this. I said, I don't have to explain it because Chester Wiggers did in his multiple confessions. People always say, well, Chester confessed under duress, that he was forced to confess. And I maintain that he wasn't forced to confess, and it's easily to be proven. When people talk about, Chester told me to my face in one of two interviews and actually he said it in both interviews, he said, I signed this confession at a point of a gun, that it was already typed up for me, and at a point of a gun, I had to sign the confession, literally a gun stuck in his face. Well, that was his story in my interviews. Now, if you interview him, he said, well, I was beaten
right,
by the cops into confession to the crime. Well, right there, his story changed. Well, right. Which was it? Point of a gun or beaten? But let's riddle this out. If you study the case, study the night of his confession, which would be November 17th, 1960, almost 8 months after the murders. Almost 8 months after the murders. The two cops that were questioning him, and they were really, you know, pushing on him to tell the truth. They let Chester be seen by a doctor. They let Chester be photographed bare-chested. They put him in a lineup with other people. They had him identify for other crimes and other situations that night. They let him see his mother. They let him see his wife. They let him see his father.
Right.
And what do they forget about most of all and never bring up? The court reporter sitting in the room. She was a mother of two. She was a longtime employee of LaSalle County court system. Her job was to take every word spoken in that room down. Would she be a party to railroading a young man, a father of two, into a crime that he could have received the electric chair for?
Right.
What was her purpose? What was her goal in life? And Chester Weegar, you know, you said, well, he signed the confession. I have a copy of the confession. Right. He signed every single page of
right.
the confession.
Yeah, I've seen and that the in the documentary. Trick, flip through it, and you see yeah. his signature on every single
every
page.
Every single page. He initialed every photograph that was placed in there. And oddly enough, I found out, not just kind of recently, that they did an old trick in that confession. What they do when they you know, is they transcribe it by a court reporter. She types it up herself, and then she intentionally, I was told this, intentionally left small typos in the confession. So when they read it with Chester, they said, oh man, there's a typo. Why don't we just change this word spelled correctly?
Right.
Just put your initials on it. So
gotcha.
Throughout the page, you see little scratch out with CW.
To show he read it.
And to that proves he read it. App.
Right.
There you go.
Interesting.
So
that's a very interesting, and it's a trick,
yeah.
but it's not really against the law.
It's just to show that he actually read it.
As he actually read it, and he said, and if you read the confession, and it is in my book, if you read his entire word for word confession, he explains how he did it, and we'll never know what really was done in that cold canyon on March 14th, 1960. We won't really know, but what does Weegar tell us what happened?
Right.
And does it fit in everything that they found, everything that they had? And a lot of, you know, the airplane sealed the deal for me. And well, I'll just explain that part of the story. Chester says that he followed the women down from the lodge after a late lunch, March 14th, 1960. He confronted them in the canyon. He told them that if they would agree to be tied up, he would turn around and leave them alone. I believe that's true. He says as he turned to leave after he tied three women up, and he didn't really take anything because they didn't have anything with them, just binoculars, camera, and such. And we'll get back to those little facts in a second. But so his words were that he leaves them tied up in the canyon, turns to leave. One of the women runs up behind her and hits him in the back of the head and in the side of the face with binoculars. Broken binoculars with the strap broken were found underneath the snow at the time that the bodies were discovered 2 days later. So that context, when this woman hit Chester, Chester said that he instinctively reached down, grabbed a log off the ground, turned around, hit this woman, she went down, and then he realized he has to go back and do damage to the other two women because He wanted to prevent any later identification, and that's just what he does. He finishes them up and stuff. But the thing that really nails this whole case together for me, there's a lot of the factors, but the nail in the case is that they asked him a simple question. Well, Chester, why did you move the body? You had him, incapacitated, dead or dying, and they're not going to do any harm for you. They're not running out of the canyon, that's for sure, because they were very well hurt. And why'd you move the bodies? I heard a sound and looked up. Remember, it's March, no leaves on the trees. He looks up, he says he sees a red and white airplane. Now, he doesn't say he saw an airplane. He names the colors of the airplane, a red and white airplane. He thought that it could be a state police plane. It could maybe somebody could see the bodies in the canyon from an aerial point of view. Let's hide the bodies up into a little cave area. It's an overhang, really, but it's a little cave area right there at the canyon. And that's what he does, and he washes the blood and the mud and everything off his pants. He hikes up the hill, goes right back for the lunch duties as his job as dishwasher at Star Rock Lodge.
Interesting.
And he goes right back to work.
Interesting.
So it's amazing to me when they do investigate his confession. What could we nail his confession that he gave us way later in November? And they kept going back to the airplane. Oh, okay. Well, where's the nearest airport? Let's find this plane. Can we find it? What a long shot. And they went to the nearest airport, the Ottawa airport. The cop pulls in the parking lot of the airport, parks next to a red and cream colored airplane. He walks up to that. He looks in the logbook, March 14th. It's in the logbook, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. About the time of the murders.
Wow.
So they said, let's keep going. Did we find the plane? They call the pilot that entered that into the logbook. He said, yeah, I flew over Star Rock that day. In fact, I was flying over Plum Island to check out there was a landing strip just to see what the winter condition was, seeing if it was still iced up, just take a look at it. Well, if you look at a map of Star Rock State Park and see Plum Island in the middle of the Illinois, it's in the flight circle path of anybody looking over that island. You circle it, and what are you flying right over, right next to it? St. Louis Canyon. Wow. That puts that plane in the air over the canyon at the time of the murders. Who told us about that plane?
Right. Interesting.
No kidding.
Wow. Who told us about that plane?
That's awesome.
Well, you know, I mean, the story is filled with a lot of irony, you know, such as what you're talking about. And, I mean, the fact that it's such a terrible thing happening in such a beautiful place. There was also, you know, supposed to be 6 women in the group that were murdered, and only 3 decided to make the trip. Isn't that kind of odd, too, Steve?
Well, it's odd because there was two women with kids that were in St. Louis Canyon on Saturday before the murders. That would be the 12th, March 12th, 1960. And they had a young man come up to them and acted rather odd and questioned them. They really got creeped out.
Yeah.
They got creeped out enough to remember this and contact authorities and said, hey, man, this, especially well, after the murders, they said, you know, we don't know if we have anything to do with this, but we were in that same canyon 2 days before the murder. This guy really creeped us out and stuff. Of course, he didn't know who he was, and that was kind of filed away until they, you know, zeroed in on Chester months and months and months later and stuff. So, yes, your question is, had their other companions come on the trip?
Sure, it might not have happened.
Sure. No, it wouldn't have happened. But right. One on our right. Man, you might be, you know, even attacking 3 women is pretty bold.
Yeah, that's tough. Yeah.
I mean, and then
even then,
when you talk about this, you always have to go back to Richard Speck. You know, he just
true.
Said, you know, Chester couldn't handle 1 against 3. Well, Speck was 1 against 6 8.
Or so. Yeah, 8.
But he did have a weapon, but still, it's just the numbers and stuff, and that affects it. But the most serious part of the case, I think, beyond the murders, is the rape robbery in 1959 in Matheson State Park.
And that's
only about a mile and a half, that park, from Starved Rock State Park. And it's probably just a mile and a half away from the canyon, too.
Right. Not
over 2 miles. And that was a situation where a young couple, I believe they're 16, 17, 18 years old, I don't remember exactly, but just teenagers, still in high school, went on their first date on a hike at Matheson State Park. Walking back about sundown back to the car, a man stepped out of the shadows. He had a rifle in his hand and a bullet in his mouth, which proves that it was a single-shot rifle. Well, you have to reload every time you shoot
it.
Right, is what I'm thinking. Well, he robbed him. He raped her, and he tied him up and disappeared into the darkness. These two kids broke free of their bonds, ran to their car, and they were, of course, in shock, crying, and everything. They drive immediately to the LaSalle County Sheriff's Department in Ottawa to report the crime. These kids were separated, interrogated, and they were not believed.
Really?
They were not believed. And what that was the attitude of rape in LaSalle County in 1959. These cops actually believed that a young couple on their first date would fool around, and they said, well, she fooled around. They're probably thinking that she is going to get pregnant. So they're just making up this story about being robbed and raped and everything else. You know, who does that?
Yeah, that's,
nobody
that's
does messy. That.
Right. Yeah. Now,
and also back in the 50s and 60s, they had fake polygraph exam, fake lie detector tests, because really the public, unlike now, where public know basically what a polygraph exam is, they didn't know. So they hooked up these kids to what they call lie boxes, which was nothing but light bulbs, electrical wires, different things.
Scientology.
On the table. You're telling the truth here, click. You're telling a lie here, click.
Right.
You're telling the truth here, click. So the thing about these kids, they sent them home. They said, we don't believe you. This never happened.
Wow.
So there was no investigation and stuff. These kids were ashamed. They never dated again.
Sure.
Imagine the shame of her going back to her high school. So this kid goes back to her high school, and she's a wreck, right? She confides her story and her sadness to a teacher there. And then after the murders and all this came out, the teacher wrote a simple letter to the LaSalle County authorities saying, well, look, I know you didn't believe these kids back in 59, but these kids were robbed at a park. They were tied up at a park.
Right.
It was a mile and a half. Couldn't these two cases be related?
Well, sure.
Well, that was filed away with hundreds of other steps.
That's unbelievable. Now, along those lines, Steve, we're dealing with the cops here in this situation. I'm not trying to badmouth them, but certainly it may be a little out of their element with all this going on. But do you think that inexperience maybe led to the fact that I read or saw that 2 days had passed in the Starved Rock murders before they actually started to investigate this thing?
Well, the park was much different in 1960 than it is in these times. In 50 years later, there wasn't hardly any visitors in the winter. It was very, and especially on the weekdays,
right,
the park was relatively empty. Now with the, with the TV advertising and a lot of promotions, there's people in the park every day. It'd be very unusual for you to go on a hike and not see anybody else.
Right.
But back then, it wasn't. So the ladies came March 14th, 1960. They checked into their rooms at the lodge. They ate a late lunch in the dining room. They hiked out into St. Louis Canyon. And they were never seen alive again after they left the lodge. Well, they were killed on a Monday. That Monday night and Tuesday, there was a tremendous snowstorm hit here. Some reports said as much as a foot of snow dropped on that Tuesday. So that eliminated even more people at the park. And so the husbands would call on Monday for their wives, say, hey, we haven't heard from the wives yet. And the front desk said, "Well, they're not around. They're not in their rooms, and we'll tell them you're called." Well, the next morning, that would be a Tuesday, the 15th. One of the husbands called again. Well, they're not here. They maybe went out for breakfast or for a hike or anything else, but we don't know anything about them. Well, on Wednesday morning, one of the husbands called again and said, well, we still haven't seen them. They must be out someplace. And the guy said, well, something's up, because somebody would have called.
For sure.
Right? So check the rooms. They went to the rooms. Rooms haven't been slept in. Towels haven't been used. Bags haven't been unpacked.
Yeah.
2 days later, they go out and find their car covered with snow. It's not been moved.
Wow.
It's not gone anyplace. They go, holy smokes, there's three people missing here. And they, they started a search that morning, and a bunch of kids, kind of like, I really don't know what to call it. Juvenile delinquents would probably be closest to it.
Right. It was from a local home or something like that, I think it says in the documentary.
Yeah, they got some kids together to help them. That was great of the kids, they were kind of, I don't know if they're considered in custody, but they were,
tightly supervised.
Glad to help. They were glad to help. They send these kids on the trails, and sure enough, they find the bodies there and stuff. So it was 2 days later, almost 72 hours, they didn't find the bodies. But that's not so unusual, because they weren't considered missing till then.
Sure.
And back then, the lodge was a different place. They didn't have TVs in the room at the lodge.
Right.
At all. So, and I don't know if they had phones in every room. I don't remember that. But the point of it is, it was a much simpler stay, because you're basically better bring a book with you. They didn't have a swimming pool.
Right.
They just had hikes. It was it was super bad weather. You're not going to leave a lot.
Pretty remote, very
remote. There's no walking to town
right
there, even though it's not too far away. It will be difficult to do in the winter.
Yeah,
such like that. So the point about 5 days later was not the police fault. And yes, they were gone 48 hours before anybody even noticed that
they
were gone.
Missing, right? Okay.
Yeah, and they gave the husbands wrong information. I think one of the husbands was told, "Yeah, we've seen them around here, but we don't know where they're at. We'll give them until you call." Well, that was just trying to blow them off.
Right.
If you're busy, somebody's called. Oh, yeah, they're around here someplace. Somebody call by. It's not no big mystery, it may be wrong to do, but it wasn't like evil or it was just one of those. And how they would know three women from three women, somebody who doesn't know. I mean, it was kind of a busy place. So that began the mystery. That's right. Three women dead in a canyon. Holy smokes, it's unbelievable. And here's the saddest part to me about the murder, beyond the killing of the three women. Okay, which of course is the worst thing you can imagine. But why are we talking to this about this case today? Why are we talking about this case right now? Is it because these three women were killed? Is it because they got a dishwasher who worked at the lodge arrested? No, we're talking about this murder because it happened in a state park.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
If it happened in a parking lot, happened in a basement someplace. Any place, we wouldn't be talking about it.
Right.
We wouldn't be talking about it at all. But we're talking about it because it was a really strange name, too.
Yeah,
a lot of reporters, a lot of media, Starved Rock. Yeah. Rock. It's just those two words.
Oh, yeah, no, it makes you wonder.
For sure. And now there seem to be issues with the one picture they found on the victim's camera. And you mentioned an issue with double exposure, but the police thought it captured the image of the killer. What do you think about that?
Well, amazingly enough, my first camera was an Argus C3, the camera that the same camera that the exact model.
The little tank.
So I know a lot about that camera being my first real camera that didn't have a plastic lens.
Right.
So when you have an Argus C3, it had a winder on it. It didn't have like a thumb winder that we're usually used to, the SLRs, the old film cameras used to have, you know, where it's just one crank, it's done. You had to turn this crank a certain amount of times to wind the film. And if you didn't turn it all the way, the images would overlap on the next frame. And so you had to be very careful how you wind that camera after every shot. Otherwise, you're going to get double exposures on frames. Well, you know, when they first developed the film out of the lady's camera, they saw a lot of these images. And, of course, the press at that time, they were hungry for the story. As the park attendants in Stays of the Lodge disappeared by regular tourists, the media moved in. And a lot of competition in the story. So people were making shit up. Excuse my language. Making stuff up.
That's all right.
They were making stuff up all the time. So they said, did what a great headline. Did the women photograph their killer on the deadly height and stuff? And they blew that way out of proportions. Well, they sent this film to the Kodak lab and stuff. And they said, geez, no, this is just a double exposure on the film. It's not a shadow of a guy, you know, hiding around a tree or a bush or something. It's just really stupid. And also, what the Kodak people, the Eastman Kodak people, could do was look at the shadows in some of the pictures and get a kind of an estimation of the time.
Where the shadows are.
And what time of day the pictures were shot. I'm sure enough it was, you know, in the mid-afternoon where they're supposed to be shot. And so it was quite eerie to see these pictures of these ladies taking photographs of themselves on their way into the canyon.
Yeah, sure. I haven't seen any of those pictures, honestly.
And they're just, you know, regular friends on a walk.
On a walk, right.
But you know, the walk they never returned from.
Right. Yeah.
But, again, to circle back to that rape robbery, for a second, when they did find out, have Wigger in their sights, when they boiled everything down and they said, well, maybe let's take a look. What else can we find against Wigger? And if someone of the police officers remembered that letter, they remembered that letter from that teacher, and they said, well, this woman thinks that crimes are related. Let's check this out. So they put Chester Wigger's mugshots and a bunch of others, went down to this little girl's house south of down here, threw them out on the kitchen table. She screams at the sight of Chester Wigger's face. Boom. They think they can get him for the rape robbery. November 17, 1960, they're going to pull him in, arrest him for the rape robbery, but they're going to put the hard press on him for the murders. So during that time, they call the kid in, the boy in, for a lineup, and of course he picks out Chester Wigger. They call the two women that saw the Chester, claim they saw a young man who appeared to threaten them, or creepy enough to remember that. Yep, that's the guy who was in the canyon with us 2 days before the murder. So, boom, they could get him for the rape robbery, and that's when they start putting the rest of the pressure there. But when they went back and looked at this robbery then and knew it was Chester. Well, Chester Wigger only lived about 300 yards from the scene of that attack over the Vermilion River on the other side of Matheson Park, just hundreds of yards away.
Wow.
No kidding.
So if these policemen would have believed this little girl and this kid,
he would have been the obvious choice.
They were raped and robbed. And why in the world would they lie? Why would they lie at that time and just put a little investigation work around the area? They might have arrested Chester Wigger for the rape robbery in 1959. These three women would have came on March 14th, took their hike, and went home.
Right.
It's the little things we do in life.
You know,
it's the little things.
It also seems, Steve, like they do a match between the twine that was found at the murder scene and the ball of twine in the restaurant where Chester Wigger, he was a dishwasher at. I mean, that seems to be pretty damning evidence. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. He admitted he carries that twine on him. He did Cats in the Cradle, a little string twine jokes, you know, with your hands you can do, you know, little puzzles. And he also said he sets snare traps, animal traps in the park with it and stuff.
Okay,
that,
same
that's,
twine.
That's true and stuff.
Yeah,
and he also tied up victims with it.
Right,
Yeah, so yeah. He uses it a lot. And let's say okay. Again, one person, four people went into the canyon. One comes out. We'll never know what really happened, right?
Right. Yeah.
But,
right.
Which is, we'll never know what really happened. But doesn't Chester Weaver have to be the saddest, most unluckiest man on the planet?
Right.
To work at the place where these women were last seen alive, to have string in his pocket from the ball of twine
right.
where
from
apparently
that,
the
right.
string came. I
right.
Could. Did the pilot lie?
Yeah,
about
just happened to see this plane. Right.
Did the court reporter lie when she took down every word that he said?
Right.
Did she lie? And it wasn't just one confession, too. He confessed eight different times.
Wow.
Eight different times at different times to different people.
Wow.
And did a full reenactment surrounded by dozens. Of court report, well, court reporter was there, but
dozens
of news reporters,
right.
TV reporters, radio reporters, and photographers. And he says, well, I was being told, if you ask Weaver about it today, as I did, I was being told everything to say. And I said, my interviews with people who were actually on the scene, it was very apparent that Chester Weaver was leading that parade. That he was telling his story, he was showing how he did it.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Now, did he have a record, Steve, of other crimes?
I
know the Matheson Park thing, but that you know he never got pinned with that.
No,
but
he didn't have any. He had a juvenile record and stuff, and you know one of the little known facts about my book is my whole first chapter I wrote about his juvenile record and put stuff in there. But then I was, after I got the book all completed, I read it myself again. I just thought, man, it makes me look like an armchair psychiatrist saying, oh, well, you know, he was always
right.
headed toward this path.
Right, right.
Look at what he did when he did it to the kid. And I said, well, that is, you know, maybe because it's about him, but I just didn't feel it was part of the story, believe it or not.
Right.
So I dumped the whole first chapter and just started with the rape robbery because I think even though it's, you know, he did bad things when he was a kid, I didn't want to be the one that said, well, this was his path.
Right. Okay.
And stuff. I said, no, my focus was in the story and people who talk about the Starbrock murders, but do not mention the rape robbery 8 months before that. They're not telling you the story.
Right.
And they're keeping it from you intentionally.
Yes.
Because it proves Weaver did it.
That's true.
Right, right. Now, what are your thoughts on Weaver getting paroled when he was 80 years old?
After I interviewed Weaver a couple times over in Stateville, that was many years ago and stuff like that, I was really stunned the first time I left. I was shaking. Because he was so believable, and if you're sitting with a person who has been convicted of a homicide, it's like you're kind of keyed up anyhow. Your adrenaline's pumping,
yeah.
And then he's saying, "Well, I didn't do it," and you want to give him the benefit of the doubt,
right?
He's sitting in front of you. How can this man sit in front of you, you know, pick up a log and hammer three women to death.
Right. When you think about it, though, how a guy like that in prison has probably told that story 400 or 500 times at least. So he's gotten pretty good at telling the story. And I think a lot of those guys have a natural charisma and come off, like you're saying, as a very believable, very, you know, heartfelt
type
of guy.
Well, you want
to believe him. Yeah. And I think that's very, very legit. I think that's you know, that would be an interesting takeaway from that.
But I found him to be smarter than I expected. I'm not saying that he's a brilliant man. I'm not saying that. But he was smarter than I expected. And, yes, I knew going to those interviews that he had answers for every question I could come up with. It was like 20, 30 years later.
Right.
You know, what am I going to ask him? So the only thing I could ask him is the one really the most important question to me. And it deals with the situation now. I go, Chester, they say if you admit a guilt now, the Prisoner Review Board looks at admission of guilt as a sign of rehabilitation, which means that if you admit guilt in this case, you are going to greatly increase your chances of parole. Right. Why won't you do that?
Right,
instead,
right.
Once you admit a guilt to save your life, okay? Point of a gun, or they were beating you up. Well, point of a gun to me. Point of the gun, they said you felt like you were going to get shot, so you confessed. Now right. You can gain your freedom.
But you won't confess.
And you won't confess to do that. You can get out of here. And he says, well, I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do and have this black cloud over my head the rest of my life. I go, that black cloud is over your head forever.
Right.
Even if they find a movie of somebody else doing it in the game.
Right.
And he said, no, he wasn't going to do it. So after 20 years later, the parole comes up, and there's a lot of doubt. Chester Wigger had back in the early 2000s, he had an attorney that tried to get the DNA testing on some of the evidence and stuff, and that was denied. And I'll tell you why that was. But there was a lot of and my book was out, and that generated a lot of interest in the case. And it's always interesting to me because I really enjoyed people reading at first, reading my book and said, well, Steve, I believe he didn't do it. And I said, what? I said, yeah, I read your book and I believe he didn't do it. I go, well, which book did you read?
Right.
You know, but I said, okay, you just proved I wrote a fair book.
Right.
If you can read that book and think he didn't do it, but you have to ignore so many different things,
right,
to get to that level,
right?
So to me, about his parole, of course I was against his parole because I stand with the jury,
right?
That's what I stand with. I stand with the jury appealed to the appellate court, and the case was upheld, and it was appealed to the Supreme Court, and the case was upheld. Yes, the appellate court, the Supreme Court has made mistakes in the past, but that doesn't mean they made a mistake in this case.
Right.
They didn't. All it tells me that professional people examined this case after it was held in LaSalle County, and two different higher courts said Chester Wigger got a fair trial and that he was guilty of this crime as he was convicted.
Right.
All I want the parole board to do was to honor the jury. They had a choice. Death in the electric chair or life in prison.
Right.
Okay? Here's my question, because I go back and forth on death penalty all the time. Could you sit in a trial, look at a young man who was 21 during the trial, he looked 18, 19 years old. He looked like a punk. His wife and his two babies sat behind him most of the time during the trial. Could you sentence a man to death in front of his two kids?
Right.
Could you?
Be tough.
That's my question.
It'd be tough.
I couldn't. When you had another sentence, we could put him away for life. Okay, I won't kill your dad, but we'll put him in a box for life. And he was portrayed as an outdoorsman during the trial. So I imagine those 12 good citizens of LaSalle County thought, well, let's put the outdoors guy in a box.
Right.
The rest of his life. There's the punishment for this guy. If Chester looked older, if Chester wasn't married, if Chester didn't have his kids sitting behind him, we probably wouldn't be talking about this case again today because he would have probably been killed in the electric chair back in the early 60s.
Right.
That's what people forget. So what do I want when people ask me about parole and how I feel? I want what the jury decided. We put the jury in charge of the decision. It wasn't lawyers. It wasn't judges. It wasn't It wasn't the court. It was a jury put him in the box.
Right, right.
I want the jury. So years later, the parole board, even though they heard testimony from crying sons and granddaughters of these victims, and they're both like 60, 70, they're old people too.
Right.
Now they're kids and they're grandkids crying to the prisoner review board. Don't let this man out of jail. He ruined our family. He wrecked our lives. Look what he did. And then they turn around. Oh, we feel compassion for you, but we're going to set this guy free because he's old and harmless.
Yeah, but
yeah, he's old and harmless. And I don't want Chester Weir Cole sick, wet, tired, anything. I just want what the jury wanted. Is that wrong? I want what the jury wanted. It was their decision. And to overrule their decision, no matter how many years has passed, is entirely wrong. And I believe that some of those pro board people just didn't do what I've done today. Talk about the facts in the case.
Right.
Talk about things. Not to say, one guy against three women? Boy, that could never happen. Let me go on to the next page. Let's read some other case.
Right.
That's what I think happened. They just didn't know the facts of the story.
True.
They didn't know the facts of the story. So now they're still trying to get now he's on parole. We could talk about parole and COVID a second, because that's interesting to me. Just think about it. He got out of jail last February, a year ago, in 2020. He got out of jail in the middle of February and stuff, his physical release from prison. He goes there. He goes to a halfway house in the Chicago area. And what, 2 weeks later, a week later, COVID hits strong. Everybody's quarantine. He goes from one prison to another. Right. Let me help you about the old prison.
Yeah,
basically, yeah.
He has friends in the old prison.
Right.
If he has a toothache, does he have to make an appointment?
Right.
Does he have to leave the facilities? Does he wonder what his next meal was? Where he's going to eat it?
Right.
I know he gets taken care of there, and he's very elderly. He's 81 years old, and he looks very, very fragile and stuff. But you know, give me a break on that. He goes from one prison to another,
right.
And I think that was kind of like some kind of
karma,
some kind of justice, justice from God. Now I'm going to you may be free, but you're not going anyplace,
right?
So
that's an amazing thing too. DNA. Let's talk about DNA for a second. A lot of the attorney, his original attorney in the 2000s, tried to get DNA. What they did find when they went up to the top of the courthouse was the same thing I found when I did my research and was allowed up there by the county state's attorney's office. I was given access to the attic up in the old courthouse. So I went up there, looked at all the evidence. Well, what they did back in 1960, after 61, after the trial, they just bundled all the evidence up in one bag, in one trash bag. So they put the women's clothes, they put Wigger's clothes, they put the evidence from the trial,
Jesus.
all in the same container. Of course, cross-contamination.
Right, definitely.
Right? And stuff. So that's what the courts ruled, said, you know, we're not even going to go there because it's all been contaminated.
Yeah.
It won't prove anything in court. Well, now there's another, after he gets paroled, I sense that there's attorneys out there that smell, well, maybe we can get a wrongful conviction in court. And if we start with the DNA, because DNA is much better now than it was even 15, 20 years ago. Let's look at some of the evidence that wasn't presented at trial. Well, here's my contention, fellas, is that I've touched the evidence. I've tried on Wigger's jacket. I went through all the materials. I've touched them. Is my DNA not on there?
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Am I the only one with access to this material over the 40 years? No.
Right. Well, what
sure
do you think?
A courthouse, go ahead.
I was going to say, I had seen something on YouTube with that interview with the sister of Smokey Rona, that she claims he was hired by one of the husbands to kill the three women. A little bit of a involved story. I was like half following it, knew I was going to be talking to you, but you know, she's thinking like 18 to 21 people were involved. I mean, that just seems very, very over the top. But I mean, do you know much about her or that claim?
I'm sure she loved his brother. You know, it has evolved into a deathbed confession.
Right.
So Smokey Rona was a famous bad guy in town and stuff. And actually, I met him once. I got retroactive fear after meeting him. I didn't know who I was meeting at first until they told me afterwards. I go, well, I'm scared after the fact.
Right. That's should be.
Because he was just kind of a famous bad guy. There's a lot of different things you could say about it and such. But let's just look at the facts of what she claims. He said 18 guys. I can't keep three of my friends from not revealing a secret, let alone 18 people involved with a triple homicide. And then again, it was the money. Well, how much was your brother paid? But do you remember the amount? Was it 15, 20?
I think she says 25,000 in the documentary interview.
Let's call it 25,000. Let's go back. In 1960, how much was $25,000?
Yeah, right.
Right. 75,000.
New cars cost about $1,900.
Right.
Those are new cars.
Right.
A house you could buy for 10 grand, decent house. It wouldn't be a mansion, but a decent house. If you made $10,000 a year in salary, you were doing fine. You were making a living wage of $10,000. So you're telling me that one person, Smokey, got paid $25,000. Is that 25 times 18?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
It seemed
outlandish. I just see what you thought.
Crazy. It involves how do you argue against the guy in debt?
Right. That's what I thought too.
Easy to say. So it's really said this to me.
Right.
But when you really pour out the facts, they say like that 18 guys, $25,000. That's not a lot of money right there.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I heard you mention there's a new documentary being filmed about it. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, not too much. But let's look at the facts. What's a documentary? A documentary is a study of a story or an issue that has a point of view. What's the point of view in this case?
Right.
The point of view in this case has to be, well, Weir didn't do it.
Right. I was just going to say that probably going for a Making the Murderer type of a docuseries where you get sucked in to these off, like you were saying, Steve, some of these tangents that they claim that, you know, don't really explain that he didn't do it, but just put a shred of doubt. And they certainly slant them very much from one bias to the next. So I think you're right.
Especially
I think it would
be. I'm told it's going to be an episodic documentary, which means
they're
come
huge
out.
Now. Yeah.
So how do they end each part? Well, they end it with a cliffhanger.
Yep.
To make you watch the next part.
Exactly.
And what are they going to end in this case? You know, Steve Stout was right. Find out how more right he is than the next one. We're not going to do that.
Well, it's like that docuseries with that guy that claimed he is a great-grandson of H.H. Holmes, but that Holmes was Jack the Ripper, you know, and it's like this really out there claim. And there was one part where they had an expert testify that this knife was used by doctors at the time. They said, see, H.H. Holmes was a doctor. It's like, yeah, but there was like how many doctors in the world?
Like, that's
just absurd, you know?
Right.
So they do string those things out.
They take one little question or one little nugget, and then it just blows into something quite big.
I think you're right, though.
As far as the DNA tested now, I've been to court a couple of times when the attorneys were there talking. It's being continued now. So they keep asking for these little pieces of evidence that were not 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 use that trial to test them. And I don't know, even if there's so many people who touch this evidence, there's so many different people. Like I already said, now, when they remove the bodies from the canyons, what type of rubber gloves did they use?
Right.
Right.
Well,
right.
They didn't. Well, I know. How many people took that? Was it 2, 5, 6, 12 people? Okay, then you have to take them to a funeral home for the autopsies. How many people touched the bed? How many assistants? How many ambulance drivers? How many people touched these? But so, what does the evidence tell you? That I've touched the evidence, and I'm going to get. Will finding somebody else's DNA in this garbage prove anything of Chester Weir's innocence? I say no. I'm not an attorney, but. I just logical. It says no. And what are they seeking justice? Let's ask that. Are they seeking justice for this case? Or are they seeking money from a wrongful conviction?
Yeah, that's probably it. Yeah.
What's their top priority? And if you were doing this for justice, wouldn't you talk to somebody who might know a little bit about the case?
Right.
Right.
Me.
Right.
Now, a lot of people have died, and I'm only getting to be the final expert on the case because I wasn't alive then. Somebody that one of the criticisms I've got when I read, well, it looks like you should have done more in 1960, Steve, when this case was really happening. I was 8 years old.
Right, I was like, come on, man,
a little early.
Yeah. Give me a break, guys. But the point of it is, it is a case that changed the way state police invest crimes. The mistakes and lessons learned in this case actually made everybody in the state of Illinois safer. So the state crime lab was totally embarrassed by this case. It was found to be less than a high school biology laboratory, their laboratory. And we sent a lot of the evidence out of state to Michigan, to other state labs and the FBI, because we just didn't have the facilities here to take care of it. So after this case was resolved, 61, 62, they poured a lot of money and manpower into the Illinois State Crime Lab, but it's one of the finest in the nation. Well, that means finest in the world.
Really?
Here in Illinois.
Right.
I was at a law day exhibit out to our local mall years ago. They had the state crime lab there. They had some, PR, a little booth telling people about the state crime lab. I go up to the technician there. I say, well, tell me a little bit about the history of your agency. He says, well, we go back to the Starbrock murder. Say, didn't that happen around here someplace? Right. Oh, good answer. That's a good answer for me. Thank you. Yeah. So that's an admitted answer by the state police that they consider their laboratory's history to go back to the Starbrock murders. Yeah. That alone changed the system and made this crime very important in the annals of Illinois state criminal history. The documentary will be interestingly put out, even though I'm sure they'll give a lot of these people airtime,
right,
and have their say when I feel they really don't deserve it. When I first told some of my friends in Chicago that I was moving to LaSalle County and writing a book on the murder, well, actually, I didn't tell them I was writing a book. I just said I moved to LaSalle County. I'm going to live, very close to Star Rock State Park. Oh, we used to go there. We used to go to Star Rock all the time. But, you guys had murders down there, so we don't go to Star Rock. I said, well, you had a fire in Chicago, and that's why I don't go to Chicago. Bad things happen in good places.
Yeah,
that's
what
happened here. Star Rock State Park is my favorite spot on the planet. It's an amazing, beautiful place. It is the jewel of state parks within the Midwest, and it's a very, very safe place. But for one day in 1960, it became a really, really sad place, and that was because of one man. And when you think about this crime in the future, any crime, as you guys talk about it, it's always three things. It's motive, opportunity and nature. The motive of the Starbrock murders, robbery. How can we prove it? The attorneys, smart attorneys, tell you, well, Steve, it's not robbery. He didn't take anything. He didn't take the camera, didn't take the binoculars. Ladies, didn't have anything missing. He didn't take watches or rings or anything. He didn't take anything. I said, he didn't want to pawn anything. He didn't want to sell anything. He was looking for money. He was looking for green dollar bills. That's all he wanted. He right. didn't want anything else. You say, and so people who listen to, oh, you're right. How could it be robbery? He left all this shit. Right, he left right. all this stuff. How could it be robbery? Well, easy. He wanted money. They had none.
Right.
Didn't want the possessions.
Right.
Yeah. So there's about opportunity. Unluckiest man in the world, right?
Right.
He's off.
Works there, lives there.
Of the murders, right. only what, a half mile, quarter mile, three quarters of a mile away from the lodge, with the string from the lodge in his coat jacket. Unlucky. Nature. What was his nature? Well, in September 1959, he attacked two little kids.
Right.
Right.
Raped one of them, robbed the other one, tied them up, and let them be damaged for the rest of their lives.
Right.
Well, yeah.
So
motive, opportunity, nature.
Right.
So, Steve, I really want to thank you for taking the time to do this interview with us. I learned a lot from you. Like, right, I love your book. Your book was amazing. I picked it up at Starved Rock whenever I was there when I was a kid. And, you know, it became a very interesting case to me. And having been able to talk with you today with us here at Murder Mel Mayhem was really awesome. And I got to learn a lot. So I just really appreciate you talking with us.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Well, I appreciated the intelligent questions and your ability to understand basic facts.
Yeah,
right, right. You
know. Well, thanks, Steve. Well,
yeah, thank you very much, Steve. It's good talking to you.
Thank you very much. Good luck, fellas.
You bet.
Mother, man.